This episode was produced on the lands of the Gadigal people. We pay our respects to the elders past and present. Welcome to the snowsbest.com podcast, diving deep into the emotions and experiences that mountain life provides for skiers and boarders, from first-timers to elite athletes. With your host, Miss Snow-It-All, Rachel Oakes-Ash.
Today's guest is a professional leisure athlete, entertainer and comedian. Think of her as the ski world's Celeste Barber. You may know her from Instagram or as the star of indie comic film, ski film, Dream Job, and now star, writer and director of her first feature film, Weak Layers, a movie for the every ski town person, or every anti-hero really, that debuted this northern winter. Welcome to the Snow's Best podcast, queen of keeping it real in the outdoor comedy world, Katie Burrell.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so much fun.
So you've been very busy, very, very busy. How's the last month been for you with Weak Layers?
I have been. My body is officially doing that moment to take a break and everything shuts down on you thing where I've gotten a cold and my energy is just tanked. And I've been going so hard, it feels like, for the last few months, really. Our first premiere, like proper festival premiere, was in Banff, which was in early November. We went to Kendal in the UK, and then we went to Whistler in BC. I've had the chance to screen the film with various audiences now at three different festivals. The process of booking theaters and doing press and PR prep and et cetera, leading up to it is just leading up to the theatrical release is just a new game for me. I haven't done anything at this level before, obviously. So I'm very used to posting stuff to my Insta stories and being like, check it out. But actually learning how to do this at this level, it's a little overwhelming and intimidating at times. But I was explaining to someone on my team recently that I feel a little bit like the frog in the boiling pot of water theory lately is very applicable to my life, where you had told me 3 years ago in the process of Weak Layers started that we would be doing a theatrical release across the US and Canada in AMCs and Cineplexes. I wouldn't have believed you. But now that it's, you know, we're 3 weeks out really from that opening weekend in theaters, and I'm just like, yeah, makes sense. Yeah.
Didn't that sell out in like an hour?
So the opening weekend in Tahoe sold out in like an hour. Yeah. The people of Tahoe are making me feel like Taylor Swift, the way they're like adding shows and selling that theater out. The Art House in Tahoe is a small theater. So it's like a little bit of a marketing spin online where you're like, and we've sold out for a week in Tahoe. It's like, well, I think the theater sits like 150 people.
But we love the spin. It's all about the spin. Isn't that what the ski world is all about?
Oh, we live for the spin. That's what it's all about. You can do a market. You can do a university degree on the spin these days.
Yeah, absolutely.
The opening weekend is, I mean, it's going to be in maybe 100 theaters across the US and Canada. And so it won't be sold out in all those places. Like, I doubt the Philadelphia theaters will be sold out, or the New York City Times Square AMC will not be sold out. But the Tahoe Art House is absolutely sold out.
And what about Canada? I can imagine Canada would sell out because you're Canadian.
I mean, these are big theaters. I just don't know what kind of reach we really have. I mean, this is a scrappy indie with no big names. We're not looking at like a Barbenheimer or a Wonka kind of press juggernaut accompanying it. So aside from, you know, my friends and family and wonderfully supportive followers and the networks of the rest of the team, I'm just very curious to see where and how it'll sort of proliferate and who will get in to see it. And yeah, this is my first time doing anything like this.
I know, but that's kind of exciting because really before this film came, well, before you came about, really, the whole ski world in particular, it was just ski porn, wasn't it? It was just a bunch of bros skiing a ton of powder over and over again and everybody just watching it going, yo, yo, yo. The white privileged males of the freaking Trustafarian world filling up cinemas in expensive towns just going, yo, dude, you rock. Then we started to get a little bit of narrative and we started actually having a lot of female film producers. And so like Nat Segal and Anna Segal did their Finding the Line about fear in the big mountains. And then Lydia Lassler, I'm just naming Australians, of course, Lydia Lassler did Will to Fly, which was a documentary about her story. And then Dream Job came around, which to me was just freaking hilarious and revolutionary at the same time, because we all take the piss. And if you don't, particularly if you're Australian or Canadian, we all take the piss in ski towns, but rarely have we actually seen that on the screen. And I mean, you nail it every single time.
Thank you.
Now you've got this fantastic film. And before I just sit here telling everyone how great you are, we should actually talk about the film because not everyone will have seen it yet. So we should probably explain a little bit about it.
Of course.
How would you describe the plot?
The plot of Weak Layers is basically the story of a classic 30-something in a ski town who has lost a decade of her life to drinking, partying, and skiing, and never having actually pursued anything that matters to her for fear of failure, looking maybe like she's bad at something. And she's currently living in a rental house when we find her with two friends who are both 10 years younger than her, so are sort of a little bit more justifiable in their sort of shithead behavior. And,
and
she's just been dumped. She's just been dumped by her boyfriend, who's decided he needs to pursue his sexuality in new ways and hasn't had the strength to come out in the absolute clusterfuck of homogenous ski town culture. And so she can't even be mad at him. And so we find her very much in her victimhood. And these three love to party and they love to cause trouble and they love to ski, and they promptly are evicted from their rental house by throwing a massive rager in it. And then they have to beg for the ex's van, to live in the van while they try to secure housing. And this all sort of coincides with the biggest ski film competition and ski film festival, a la something like Deep Winter or the TELUS World Ski and Snowboard Festival in Whistler, the ones called Hot Laps. And by sort of a confusing series of events, this ragtag trio ends up in this competition. And Cleo, our protagonist, is able to pursue her dream of becoming a ski filmmaker, her sort of closeted dream of becoming a ski filmmaker, for the first time in really since she arrived at the ski town and started bartending.
And it's through desperation, though, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the interesting thing about Cleo is that had we found her at any other time in her life, maybe she would not have had the 72 hours that she goes and ends up having, because she would have come up with another excuse to run away and hide. She would have continued to sort of stay in her own sort of self-limiting beliefs and her own patterns and your own shit, your own worst enemy you get in your own way. But because of this sort of rock bottom moment, the breakup, the eviction, the lack of cash, her friends starting to drive her increasingly crazy, and her sort of starting to see herself for the first time, you know, the central joke there being that the coming of age story in a ski town happens in your 30s, not your 20s or your teens, because we're all sort of stunted in development when it comes to ski town dwellers and snowboarders. She has this outrageous sort of series of events, including, you know, a romance with the hottest, cool, like most famous skier in the world, and a rivalry with one of the most famous ski filmmakers in the world, and then a sort of come to Jesus moment with her friends and herself as to whether or not she wants to stay in the same loop that she's been sort of eddying in for the last however long. And I shouldn't tell you anymore.
No, we don't want to hear. We don't want to hear anymore.
Anyway, I'm absolutely terrible at elevator pitches. I can't say anything succinctly.
Yeah, in 30 seconds. You deepen the film before you actually realize, in a way, you're in a rom-com.
It's been a controversial topic whether or not this thing is a rom-com, because from like a screenwriting perspective, the A story is very much focused on Cleo's hero's journey, or her arc, if you will. And the relationship with her two friends are sort of the catalyzing, her two female friends are sort of the catalyzing plot keys, if you will. However, the Gabe story, and Evan, Jonikite, my co-star, did such a fantastic job of bringing him to life that I think that Gabe ended up being a bigger character in the movie than maybe we had expected because of Evan's performance and the way that he delivered Gabe and the way he brought Gabe to life. I mean, in the edit, we were all sort of smitten with, like, Anna, my editor, and I, we were just kind of smitten with the way that Cleo and Gabe came up on screen. And we were kind of saying the same thing. We're like, wait a second, is this rom-com?
Yeah.
To me, I'm not afraid of it being a rom-com. I think that there was a bit of concern about it being a rom-com with it following sort of a heteronormative arc in that sense that maybe doesn't do anyone
any justice.
Yeah. Or it doesn't focus on the women, if that makes sense, in the same way, if we call it a rom-com.
Yeah, but the women are such a major part. And to me, look, there are a couple of things that I loved. First of all, because you just don't see half of this shit in ski towns, you know? You're not seeing an African-American. You're not seeing a lot of Asian-Americans or Asian-Canadian. You're not seeing gay people as much either, unless it's Gay Pride Week, and that's about it, which sometimes feels like tokenism. There's so much female energy in this film, but at the end of the day, everyone wants to be loved, regardless
totally.
Of what your narrative is. Everyone wants to be loved.
Without giving the ending away, when we test screened it in LA way back in May, I guess, we asked the question whether or not we could kill part of the romance, part of the rom of the com, if you will, and if it would sort of detract from the audience's view of the film, because we did want to focus on the A story and the women, and the resounding response from the crowd was, who doesn't love watching people fall in love?
Exactly.
Everybody loves watching, you know, everybody loves watching that. It's so fun and it's so relatable and you can see yourselves in it, and it's just a treat.
I don't feel it took away. I still feel the other story, without giving up way too much, I do feel that story of Cleo's journey and how Cleo comes to some major self-realizations is still the number one story over and above the rom-com element.
Yeah.
There is a moment in the film at the end where I was actually surprised how moved I was. I actually teared up. Is that because we've all lived in ski towns? Is that because we've all experienced that Peter Pan and the gunning for someone to actually become really successful, or the acknowledgement of other people within the community, all of that kind of stuff? That really moved me a lot, because the ski world, you know, we're all so serious about these ski celebrities who, by the way, are hilarious when they make those little cameos. And nobody outside of the ski world would even know who these people are.
Totally. I think that the ski world itself is, I don't even know if you can really call it a microcosm for society at large, because it's such a...
No, not for anything else.
It's
no.
Such a homogenous sort of culture. But I do think that the ideas, the experiences of feeling like a nobody, or feeling like an outsider, or feeling like you really want to accomplish something in your life or make something of your time on earth, I don't think that those are necessarily specific to skiing or the ski industry. I think that those are like a life experience. And so I think when Cleo has her come to Jesus moment around that, it's really about her coming into herself and leaving a legacy and not getting caught up in the crowd and people pleasing and doing the thing that, going against the grain a little bit, if you will, and following her own inner voice. And I think that that doesn't just happen for people in this, just in the ski industry. So I think that's sort of a universal, relatable moment.
Which is a great terminology, because that's what Hollywood is constantly looking for, isn't it, in feature films, universal themes. So how did you sell this ski film that's not really a ski film? I see it as, you know, universal themes, using a ski town and the ski world as the setting and place to tell a universal story. How did you sell this to Hollywood, who traditionally just like to get a film and then place it in a ski resort and have absolutely no freaking idea what they're talking about?
I have to give so much credit to the producers here, because they, Jared Drake, Marco Galuski, Andrew Ladd, Steven Sig, Noah Lang, these guys were hellbent on making a ski movie that harkened back to the ski comedies of Aspen Extreme and Hot Tub Time Machine and Hot Dog, etc.
Yep.
But they knew that that wasn't going to fly in the climate, in the current climate.
Yeah.
So they wanted to find a story that felt really, really, really authentic to the ski industry and skiing itself and snowboarding. And when they saw Dream Job, they reached out to me and said, will you pitch? Because they were shopping various writers, LA-based, full-time professional screenwriters. When I sent back a pitch to them, I think the biggest thing that they saw in it was the authenticity factor. and the voice coming directly from my experience with the actual ski industry, having worked in it, having been in it, having lived in a ski town. I had a finger on the heart of skiing and ski culture in a way that I don't think the rest of the quote unquote Hollywood writers did. They took a risk, really, partnering with me and hiring me because I was a first timer writer, director, actor, and they took a real risk. And I am forever grateful to them for it. They partnered me with Andrew Ladd, who is an experienced longtime Hollywood screenwriter. I mean, he and I brought the script to life together, but the original pitch and the original concepting that I did, I think the selling feature was just the fact that this isn't going to be another ski movie that feels like Hollywood tried to make a ski movie and made it kind of embarrassing because yeah. We're actually going to have that real voice coming from within it. And I was so militant on set about it, about making sure, oh my God, talk about Evan bringing Gabe to life. There I am trying to sell this guy as the hottest, coolest, most dialed, most famous skier in the world. Guy is like not a skier. He's like a baseball golfer guy, like lives in Florida, you know, New York, Florida guy. He's going to be mad at me for saying that. He can like hike as well. But
that matters then. Yeah.
Every time I turned around, he had somehow like pulled his helmet up and the goggles are down. He has a Gorby Gap or he has his neck warmer. Like he's got it unzipped. I'm like, I'm going to style you. And then we're going to set the rest of the scene up and we're going to light it. Do not move. Don't touch your shit.
Don't change anything. Do not put your ski pants into your boots.
Exactly. And these little things that your average skier, recreationalist, whatever, might not even have an awareness of, to core skiers and snowboarders, like ski style, the way you present on your gear, the way it's, I mean, it's so frickin' bourgeoisie and sort of gross.
Well, it's very fresh. Isn't it? It's like a fraternity. Yeah.
It is, but it's also like it was incredibly important that Gabe looked completely dialed every minute of the day, watertight. You know, I was like texting one of my 25-year-old ski bro buddies whether or not they tie their hoodies up in knots still anymore if they leave them loose, and he's like, "We still tie the hoodie." I'm like, "You have to tie your hoodie." I'm sorry, like this is important.
Yeah, gotta tie your hoodie. Yeah, that's awesome.
I think that those little details really come through and don't really take you out of the story in the same way that a Hollywood-based crew may have. At the same time, the sled stuck scene, the sled is not that stuck because we can't get the sled that stuck because the sleds were, you know, given to us by Ski-Doo for a day of work. And if we send back sleds that we've wrecked one of the, you know, guards or whatever on, it's not going to be a good relationship factor. So, you know, the sled stuck is like sort of stuck. It's Hollywood stuck, you know, and those are the sort of the hills you can't really die on.
My favorite line in the movie is actually in the opening scene, the line where you go, "You work in finance, don't you?" And he's like, "Yep." And you're like, "Yeah, I could tell." And I'm like, "Oh my God, that is so true. It's so true. If you live in a ski town," and I love how his credit is ski tourist guy.
Drunk tourist guy. Yeah, DTG. And we literally had, that's Kevin Elena. He's an LA-based actor. He's amazing. We had him literally like in the ski sweater that he probably skied in, even though it's like not really supposed to be like technical wear.
Yeah, it's no technical.
The Gore-Tex jacket that he's just got undone. You know, I'd imagine it flapping in the wind. And I'm talking to him in the bar and I'm going pizza french fries and he's going pizza french fries. Like he's just taking a lesson and he's having a sort of really spiritual experience out there for the weekend by himself. This guy thinks he's having the most profound, like intrepid, adventurous weekend. He's going to go back and put on his Hinge profile in San Francisco. Like he's a real adventure type. He's looking for an adventurous kind of gal. But to any girl that actually lives in a ski town, it's like, this guy, you know, wouldn't survive, you know, 2 feet of cold water.
He's holding his skis in his shot, in his profile shot. It's just like, instead of a fish. It's so funny. I just thought he was absolutely brilliant. And it took me back also to, we all have that moment of when we first learned to ski. I mean, I first learned to ski as an adult and I was absolutely completely and utterly clueless. I thought I was a really good skier because my ski instructor kept telling me I was. So after three days, I thought I was shit hot. And then I found out I couldn't actually ski down even a blue run when I was trying to ski with somebody I was supposed to be meeting up with. I was like, oh, this is so not happening. And then it continues on like that, doesn't it? person. I mean, I went to the, not to make it about me, but it was, but your film was, is quite funny because it does make you go, oh my God, that's happened to me. I went to the Ski Superstars camp in Chile, in Portillo, with Chris Davenport, Mike Douglas, Shane McConkie, all these guys. I had no freaking clue who Shane McConkie was when I arrived. I'd only been skiing for like a year and a half. God knows what the hell I was doing at that Superstars camp in the first place. And I had to Google him and I'm like, oh yeah, this guy's kind of a big deal. And then there was a 2 meter snowstorm that we all got stuck in, and I ended up stuck in the Love Boat meets The Shining. That's how I would describe Portillo. And there was 10 of us, and it was Shane, Dav, myself, and a couple of finance guys from Boston. And I just sat there and think, I look back now and just go, oh my God, I was so freaking clueless. I was skiing. I wouldn't wear an over jacket. I was only wearing a base layer because I thought I looked better in the base layer. I was just seriously like clueless. Oh, they must have just looked at me and gone, Jesus. And then I broke my leg. No surprises there. So your film is like that, right? You just sit there and it is so relatable on so many levels. From the moment you first start skiing to the moment you're like, yeah, I'm a ski pro now, leisure athlete, you know, I've been living in a ski town. It really is fantastic. You wrote this film in COVID, didn't you?
I started the outline in COVID. Yeah. There was a process around the outline and the treatment. Yeah. I started the first draft in COVID. COVID had this sort of slow opening and then a closing and then an opening and a closing. And by the time this first draft was done, it felt like we were opening. We were thinking we could go to camera and Omicron hit, bam, shut us back down. It was definitely a COVID project in a lot of ways. I got sent home from a documentary I was working on over in Europe in March of 2020. We had gotten the call from Jared and Sig in February of 2020. And so when I was sitting in my rental house in Vancouver with nothing to do, because we didn't really know what we were going to do about our documentary that all of a sudden didn't have an ending anymore because the whole world had shut down, I went to work on this outline 3 years later. So
that took 3 years, didn't it, to bring it? Yeah,
it really did. I think ultimately it was a 2 year project that took 3 years. At the same time, think it was a 3 year project, because any other time that we talked about going to camera, it didn't feel like we were ready or it was real. And when we actually started moving on the fall of 2022, the way things started coming together, it didn't happen like that the other two times we were talking about it. The third time that we were like, all right, this is our window and we're going for it, it felt different. Looking back on it, I think that there were a lot of kinks that needed to be ironed out. There were a lot of questions that need to be asked amongst the producing team. There was a lot of, I mean, there were logistics upon logistics that I was never privy to as the director and star, that I never had to deal with the mountains of shit that the producers had to deal with in just getting a runway to camera. Looking back on it, I think that Omicron in a lot of ways was actually sort of a blessing in disguise, because we were prepared as we could be, or much more so prepared going into the fall of 2022. And then we got horseshoes up our ass lucky with this insane snow cycle that started in freaking November. So there we were with $5,000 worth of snow blankets in a truck that one of our team had driven up from LA, ready to make things look like winter at a given moment. And it's just started snowing. Right now, it's December, it's raining in Tahoe. If we had tried to shoot this movie this year, if we had tried to shoot the movie the year before, it would have been a completely different game. And one of the factors that's so brilliant about this film is that it actually looks like winter. And we couldn't afford or logistically make it happen in the dead of winter, because Palisades, who was a huge partner on the film, Palisades Tahoe, they're so busy during their peak season, they couldn't shut down a chairlift for us to use for a day, which they did in early December for us. They couldn't do things like let us use various spaces in their accommodation as holding, as wardrobe, as actual sets. So the fact that it happened in November and the fact that it snowed in a way that made it look like real winter in November was, I mean, insane. Truly, truly lucky.
This episode is supported by The North Face. The North Face fundamental mission remains unchanged since 1966. Just provide the best gear for athletes and the modern day explorer, support the preservation of the outdoors, and inspire a global movement of exploration. Now, more than 55 years after its humble grand opening, The North Face delivers an extensive line of performance apparel, equipment, and footwear. They push the boundaries of innovation so that you can push the boundaries of exploration. All of the brand work that you were doing before Weak Layers, because this has obviously taken you, as you said, to another level. Even our producer said, gosh, when you reach 100,000 followers, you're at just another level, aren't you? I'm like, no, she's done an entire feature film. This is really full on. So prior to that, you were building all of your social following and all of that, those fantastic self-deprecating piss takes on being an outdoorsy person, or the boyfriend-girlfriend stuff is the best to me. And then you start doing it with the Arc'teryx, and you start doing it with Icon, and you're doing it with everybody. Were you approaching them, or were they coming to you?
I've been really fortunate in the last few years that I don't really know if I've pitched that many companies, actually. We talk about this a lot internally, like if we should be actively pitching companies more so. But a lot of the partners that we've worked with, they see the content that we create and they have a specific idea of how their existing brand could fit into the work that I do, could fit into their existing brand. I think it's really challenging being on the outside. And my style of like brand content creation, for example, it's difficult to be on the outside of a company and not have a window into their marketing strategy and then come up with something that would really fit within their strategy, like just kind of out of the blue. You have to be a psychic, right? So, and this all that brand stuff that started in 2020, that was a COVID reaction.
During COVID,
Yeah, we were creating short films and documentaries at that time with their sort of unique spin, the comedy documentary style thing where I was like a, you know, a host of the documentary, but with a comedic take on the subject. We started doing videos because we didn't have income or cash flow. That was the way we were like, well, we could just do this and see if we build it, if they will come, kind of a thing. And so we started putting content out and brands started reaching out because they were looking for ways to access their audiences during COVID. And that's how that snowball kind of started its run down the hill. In terms of the way it is now, you know, companies will reach out primarily with a, we have this campaign, could you build it for us? The Icon Pass Heartbreak Hills, for example.
With Caroline.
Yeah. Great cameo. Caroline Gleick. They asked us to come to them with concepts. And so we listened to the brand. We listened to the team. We listened to the gaps in their communication with their audiences. We ask a lot of questions and then we go back and build concepts. And we're constantly pushing brands to try new stuff and take chances and do outrageous shit that they never would have imagined doing, because I don't know, it usually seems to cut through the noise.
It totally cuts through. The CMH stuff was brilliant. Yeah, the CMH Jelly Skank stuff was hilarious.
That was really fun. If you do the brand stuff the same way that all marketing content is, it's just more filler for the internet. And it's always sort of nerve-wracking, I think, for brands to break their own rules. But I haven't been on any campaigns that have blown up in our faces yet when we've used comedy yet. I'm sure it'll happen at some point, but it hasn't happened yet. We're very careful, of course, but
from the outside, looking at you and looking at your trajectory of your career, it does all look very easy and very natural, and that almost like it looks, you know, fatalistic, like it's supposed to be, but it can't. I mean, we all know that what you see is a press release of people's lives. There must be times where you've had extreme self-doubt around all of this.
Oh my God, every day of my life. But Colleen and I talk about this all the time. Colleen's my right hand. We've done everything together for the last, you know, almost 7 years, 6 years. She films everything, except for Weak Layers. Weak Layers was filmed by Ryan DeFranco, who's a Brooklyn-based DP. But Colleen goes, it's kind of like a bit of a fatal flaw in some ways to make things. She goes, you make things look really easy. She goes, you make this stuff look easy. And so people think it's not that hard. And so they think they can ask for more all the time because they don't recognize how much work is happening behind the scenes and how much time and energy, education and practice and conversations and self-development and all the stuff that's behind the scenes to create anything the years and years of working in corporate marketing. So I knew how to send an email to a CMO even, you know what I mean? Like have my own business and have my own company. Like Colleen, she says this to me all the time. There's a dance between your audience and your clients and your team and yourself where you're like, how much do I let them in on? How much of my own struggle do I let these people in on? Because I made a decision years ago that what I was, my purpose, if you will, on earth was not to educate people on foreign affairs, you know, or become wildly sort of righteous in terms of political or cultural topics. It really was to entertain. And I've always loved entertaining and I've always loved giving people a laugh. And, you know, it's just funny. It's like, but I have an undergrad in political science. It's like this kind of constant what's front facing and what's the reality of the person behind it. And I'm like a very serious comedian, if you will. I'm a very serious person in a lot of ways that puts out this goofy, nonchalant, self-deprecating take on things. And I always sort of wonder about it. Like how much of the present self-presentation or the presentation of these campaigns without any of the sort of real BTS, I don't know. It's just an ongoing sort of existential question.
It is. I think it's hard in a world where you're doing that on the internet, because when you risk showing the vulnerability of what happens with struggles behind actually creating what you create, there's the risk of trolling.
Oh my God, you're going to get trolled regardless, I think. But it's interesting is the trolling seems to happen at a certain, for me anyway, it seems to happen at a certain point. So if a video goes like properly viral, there's a moment where you're like, okay, we hit 500,000 views. Here come the dark corners of the internet with something to say. They're just on the internet with their 24 followers to be on the internet and fucking project their bullshit. Yep. I don't really take them seriously. A comment could derail my entire freaking week. Like I would get hung up on messages or comments I got for like weeks. And to this day, I have to check myself because now I just want to fight. I want to fight. I'm like,
what do you want to do? Go back at them.
My kind of default is to just, I just want to fucking fight people. I want to like bury them with whatever in the comments, like wit or sarcasm or criticism or come at them. I want to come at them so hot. And that doesn't do anything because it gives them what they want, which is a reaction.
A reaction. They want a reaction.
And then it's a classic bullying case, you know, and you're in there for the next however long and you're going back and forth with some loser in freaking middle America. But it's like, you know that you could kick this guy.
Oh, you could burn them.
You
know, burn them in a second.
Burn them.
Yeah. Yeah,
but you 100%. Have to just rise above and rise above. And I just don't always like to rise above. And I've had a few times recently where I just see the comment and I just fire off a response. And then I'm like, shit, I posted that. You're not supposed to do that. Delete. And I'm doing it on my like brand partners channels. I'm hopefully their social media manager isn't in there just being like, ah, fuck. Brel's yelling at our customers again. So, like,
have you got good support? Have you got like a therapist? Have you got good support for that shit?
2023 has been a bit of an ultra marathon with no aid stations, I would say, emotionally. But I do have a coach who's been, she's a massive support for me. Awesome. She wouldn't call herself a therapist. She's more of like a business and image and self-development coach, if you will. And I just felt in 2023,
package,
like I didn't really, totally. I mean, I saw a therapist at various times in 2023, but I didn't feel like therapy was doing what I needed at that time. It was like, I could sit there. Sometimes I catch myself in therapy sitting there and complaining and then just trying to convince my therapist that I have a reason to complain. And if she's trying to give me tools or that he's trying to give me tools, I'm like, no. Like what we're doing right now is we're just complaining and we're just
like,
going to need
You're not hearing me. You are not supporting victim mentality. Yeah.
Exactly. Whereas somehow the shift in my mind of like having a therapist versus a coach, like a coach, granted, this is victim mentality. And I'm just going to say it out loud to say it out loud. We're not going to like dedicate any time or energy to it. Can I just say it? Yeah. She's like, just say it. I'm like, here it is. She's like, acknowledged. I'm like, okay, so how are we moving through it and forward into
moving
the next thing?
Forward.
You know, I mean, I'm sure, therapists out there do that. I was just finding myself not doing that with my therapist. So I've focused on the coaching practice for now.
Well, it feels like it's the right time of your career, doesn't it? Like that feels like this, particularly, you know, you've got your whole new movie, you've got a production house, you're in the big league now. You really do want goals and plans and strategies and all those things you probably don't think about when you're just doing stand-up comedy, just trying to make ends meet.
No, I mean, the thing with stand-up comedy those days, for me anyway, is I always had to have like a 9-to-5. I never made enough money to doing stand-up at age 26 through 29 when I was kind of doing it like full-time. I always had to have a 9-to-5, which means I probably wasn't that good at it. But I never took stand-up that seriously. Like I never saw myself having a career in it. And now I look at some of the comedians that I was doing shows with back then. I'm like, damn, like, oh my God. Like they're touring all over the US. They're on Jimmy Fallon, James Corden. I'm like, could I have done this? But they were like very good. And I was like, good.
You've just done a film.
Yeah, I think I have a different sort of skill set ultimately. But I think stand-up is something that I would love to come back to and kind of tackle again in a new way. Being in your mid to late 20s versus being in your mid 30s, I think your brain is like just different and I'd love to tackle it again.
I think your content is different as well.
Yeah. Every time I get the chance to public speak, I'm like, fuck, I love an audience. Like just so fun to like really connect with a big audience and just get that hit of energy and that instant kind of loop and that you're creating this thing with them. You sometimes get it with like likes and comments of something like really pops or whatever. You're like, this is fun. I'm interacting with people. I'm getting that energy hit. But like a performer or an entertainer, like we rely on that shit. It's our fucking like lifeblood. And that's why movies are kind of like this weird. I mean, I've never done a movie like this, but it's like this quiet in a way. And then when it goes to theaters, it's just going to boom all the same weekend. It's going to go boom. It's just opening week, January 5th. It's just running. And I'm like, I can't be everywhere at once. Like I can't be in the room with people. I can pick and choose where I'm going to go. I'm going to go check it out. Various theaters. I'm going to go to, actually, we just determined my travel schedule, but I'm going to go to Tahoe and Reno and Salt Lake City and Aspen and New York and LA. And then I'm going to check out Vancouver and Revelstoke for the Canadian release. But it's like, what are the people in Toronto going to think? What are the people in Calgary going to think? What are the people in Vancouver? What are the people in Columbus, Ohio going to think? You know, it's like this releasing of control at this level that you have to do. That's just
the control wild release is hard. It's new. That to me is quite anxiety inducing because when you start to worry so much about what other people are going to think, because you know, you're putting yourself out there. It's like writing a book and you put your book out there for the first time. It's, you know, this is you. I mean, so much of this is you. This is your project. You've put your heart and soul into it.
100%.
Putting it out onto a big stage, no matter, even if you've sold out in Whistler three times over, I imagine each time it gets released again, you've still got that shit. Is it going to be okay? Is it going to be okay?
Well, the thing that happens is you think every time that you got lucky that one time. Like you think, my brain goes like, oh, well, Whistler, we got lucky because my mother was there and she's a one woman, you know, regional PR team. And she had, you know, made sure all of her friends and all of her friends' kids were there. And then they probably told their friends. That's probably why it sold out. You know, like you tell yourself these stories of why you think you're just getting lucky in these one moments. And then I'm like, how many times am I going to have to get kind of lucky until I'm like, oh, people just are here because this is maybe fun or good. It's just so new. It's just so big. And, you know, it's the drinking out of a fire hose factor, I suppose, in a sense.
Is this a Canadian thing? Is this like, because in Australia, we have this tall poppy syndrome. So once you become successful, people try to tear you down. So people try to underplay their own success, or they try or they think that if they're going to speak highly of themselves, that they're going to jinx the success of the next.
The false modesty thing?
Yeah. Just, and particularly women.
Maybe. Oh, for sure. Women are brutal for it. And I'm definitely not trying to have like false modesty or.
No, I don't think that. Yeah.
I'm trying to express from my own self-doubt how it actually feels. Like it's wild to me every time people sell out a theater and come to see the show. It sold out in the freaking UK. I'm like,
isn't that
the
awesome?
Fact that you
That's so
are
awesome.
Aware of my work and this film.
You don't realize how global you are. That's
on
why.
Earth? Well, I feel like it's so niche But it's neat. Then that's why it's global. It's niche globally, if you will. But this will be curious to see if we can make that jump into the mainstream, you know.
Oh, well, that I really hope for that. Because there's one thing about skiing and snowboarding globally is that if you're sitting in Toronto or you're sitting in Milan or you're in Thailand, in Phuket, and somebody starts talking about skiing, all of a sudden everyone's talking about skiing that skis, and it's a bonding experience. And there is a community of people, whether you're the finance guy wearing his Christmas sweater skiing down the slopes or you're the guy, you know, you're Cody doing 50 descents, you know. So there is this connection and this global community of skiers and snowboarders, which you have tapped into. I do think this is a crossover film. I hope it's a crossover film. It feels like a crossover film.
I hope it's a crossover film as well, Rachel. I have to say for me, selfishly, I really want this film to mean that I can do another one.
Will it be ski focused?
I don't know. I don't think so. I hope I can spread my wings. I have written Evan and I, my Gabe, he and I wrote a script together after we wrapped. We got on Zoom a couple weeks after we wrapped and we were like, let's work together on something. We really, really enjoyed working with him on as like a scene partner. So he and I wrote a script. We're working on a couple more. We've sort of found a writing partners in each other and that's been really fun. So I'm hoping maybe something there kind of takes off. I'm working on another script with one of my old McGill girlfriends who went and did a master's in screenwriting at USC. And she and I are working on a screenplay sort of ridiculing or Trojan horse mocking sort of new age spirituality in the form of women's retreats.
Oh, yeah. We love that.
I think that just comedy seems to be something that I really sort of connect with and feel like I can express myself with. And so taking that into different spaces would feel really exciting for me. And then, you know, of course, any opportunity I can sink my claws into, really, I will take, because I'm going to be learning drinking out of a fire hose for the entirety of my career, because I do feel like a bit of a late bloomer in a lot of senses. I mean, I'm 35 and this is my first feature and I have so much to learn. Still, I had so much to learn when I was on set and continue to. And so I just hope that I can continue to freaking be exposed to this stuff because it's so fun to make and so thrilling. And then giving it to audiences is like, I can't express to you how good it feels like to have audiences enjoy your work. It's just, and feel good or feel feelings
awesome.
Enjoy their night out with their partner.
Watching that film, you do feel feelings, which I don't always get from some films. You know, you definitely do feel feelings. And also it's so wonderful to watch you embrace stepping out of your comfort zone over and over and over. And understanding that that's the place where you're going to learn the most. We are very excited about, hopefully, fingers crossed, getting you to Australia and getting the film to Australia. So we'll see how we go with that.
Oh my God, I love Australians.
Oh, have you been here? Have you been here? Because we're working on this. I've been talking to Jared.
I have been to Sydney once, and I will tell you that I'm pretty sure at one point I was drinking an espresso martini as a shoey out of a strappy sandal at a very high-end bar. And I was like, these people are so outrageous and unserious and like just so, you guys are like the loosest freaking people. And
we'll make sure you have just as good a time again.
They get razzed here in Canada because they're like, you know, loose and partying and like trouble and whatever. And we're like, friggin' Australians. But Australians in Australia are spectacular.
Oh, that's so nice. We've got to get you out here. You've got to get your film showing around Australia and get all of the skiers and snowboarders and the non-skiers and snowboarders as well, because it really is. I was explaining to someone today the plot line of your film and she just said to me, oh my God, we have to show it here. And my office is actually in a country town. Well, it's not really a country town, but it likes to think it is. It's a gentrified country town. I said, well, it's not a lot of skiers and snowboarders. And she said, I don't ski. I would watch that film in a heartbeat. I'm like, brilliant. There you go. There's your crossover.
I think so too. I think that there's something to be said for just the scenery, the love story, the friendship story, the arc, the hero's journey, whatever, like the bad guy.
It is very hero's journey. I love that. As a screenwriter, it's fantastic to watch. Yeah. And also the moment when Elise and Cody step off the bus.
Such a good, probably one of my favorite cameos.
Before we go, how did you get them all involved?
The Palisades Tahoe specific pros are, I mean, they're just so elite. Like they just are so elite. And so to have that sort of collection of high status professional skiers in one place is just crazy. And then B, as a result of them being, you know, locals, they're just buddies with everyone in the town. And I've known a lot of those guys just via the ski industry forever. And so we just sent emails and texts out and you want to come cameo? And all of them were like, oh my God, hell yeah. Like, you know, it's an afternoon of just goofing off on a film set. Like they're all good for it. And I was saying, actually, at the Kendall Film Festival Q&A, they asked about how we possibly got all of these like epic cameos. Jim Ryan and Madison Ostergren and Christian Johansson like flew themselves out from Jackson Hole to be a part of it. I don't know. It was just like
that moment where they're like, oh, it's the OGs.
Oh, yeah.
That like, was so great.
Travis Ganong, Darren Rolves, like U.S. ski team, legends, Michelle Parker. Like,
and of course, Scott Gaffney.
Yeah, the Scott Gaffney.
Yeah.
Playing Scott Gaffney. I think the thing about Californians is they love movies. They love movie culture. They love, it's like Hollywood culture like seeps out into the rest of that state. If we had shot this thing in Revelstoke, I don't think that the pros that live in Revelstoke would have come out the same way because of that Canadian humility, if you will. They went, I'm not a pro skier. I can't come out and cameo.
Sorry.
Versus like you ask Cody to chuck keys at a valet, he'll do it 10 times in a row. He's so down to take the piss out of himself and the industry and pro skiers. And I don't know, they just have an amazing sense of humor for it all. And they love to create shit there. And I don't know, it's just an incredible group of very high status professional skiers in that town.
Yeah, the cameos are amazing. It concerns me that a lot of those cameos will be lost on your average person who doesn't ski and snowboard, though, when they watch the film. And I go, oh, they've got no idea who that person is.
We can do like a trivia night.
But the storyline keeps it going. Yeah. Oh, trivia night. Anyway, look, it's a great film. We love it dearly. We want to bring it to Australia. I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us today, particularly considering your schedule. My God.
Oh, my pleasure.
And we wish you all the best for January. Is it 5 or 6 that's the launch in Tahoe?
January 5th. Opening weekend, theaters across the US and January 19th in Canada.
I bet that's a line you never thought you'd say. Opening weekend, January 5, theaters across America.
I know. That's what I mean. I'm like frog in a boiling pot of water.
Nah, it's awesome.
Thank you.
Enjoy it. Yeah. Anyway, Katie, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Snow's Best podcast. If you enjoyed our chat with Katie Burrell, you can follow her on Instagram at Katie Burrell TV, or check out all of the different dates for the screenings of Weak Layers at weaklayers.com. Don't forget to follow us at Miss Snow It All on Instagram and Facebook, and also check out our website, snowsbest.com.
Thanks for listening to the Snow's Best podcast. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe via your favorite podcast platform. Like at Miss Snow It All on socials. And hit up the snowisbest.com website for everything you need to know snow.